Welcome to The Great Security Debate. This show has experts taking sides to help broaden understanding of a topic. Therefore, it's safe to say that the views expressed are not necessarily those of the people we work with or for. Heck, they may not even represent our own views as we take a position for the sake of the debate. Our website is greatsecuritydebate.net, and you can contact us via email at feedback@greatsecuritydebate.net or on Twitter @securitydebate. Now, let's join the debate already in progress.
I was thinking about the parallel of that, though. You think about the marketing machine that's behind, you know, XDR, SOAR, big data, ML, take all of your buzzwords. And I feel like we could make a great security debate t-shirt that says it depends, and then have all the buzzwords listed on the back or something like that. And you have to take a shot every time you hear one of those buzzwords. But then I pivot to what Dan said earlier in the week about the administration, the Biden administration, pulling together some big tech companies on how are we going to solve the cybersecurity issue. And I, this morning, was just going through some of the responses from, you talk about Big Blue, I think Google was there. There was a number of other companies that the sound bites sound great, but will it actually change anything? I don't think it will. I think the wrong people were in the room.
I think the right people were in the room. I just think that it was more of a, that it ended up being more of a, I come back to that analogy, more of the, everyone gives the thing that they've got or that they want to market. And I'm a little cynical about that, but I think that it's the thing they want to market. And to you, Frodo, I give, you know, good backups. And to you,
I do bequeath to you.
And to you, I give a better supply chain for iPhones. Yeah. It was just a very unique set of outcomes. And I mean, I appreciate that there was this effort made to get people to think about information security, to think about, the gaps that we have. And some of the things that were in there were very positive. They were things like training. They were things like, there was an insurance company that gave their risk platform out, for anybody to use. And I think that's good, but it was only the ones that were invited that are doing this. I haven't seen other companies stepping up beyond that to say, you know, we weren't in the room, but we think that there's a gap too. And therefore we are going to add to this effort, even though we weren't in the room, we aren't formally part of it. We think we agree with this notion and we're putting out some of this stuff. If that were the case, I think there'd be, it'd be cool to see that happen, but I haven't yet heard that.
I guess the problem, and you started to hit on this, the reason I say that the wrong people are in the room is because you started heading in this direction that they, here's something else that I'm going to sell to you. And I think that's the problem. The group that they gathered, while it's a very smart group and they do a lot with the technology space platforms and all that stuff that they're doing. But at the end of the day, security is not bought, it's built. Right. And that group is just going to sell things to you. And this is the same thing we've been talking about the Cloud Security Alliance for the longest time, that you can't move into the cloud and all of a sudden think that, oh, I'm secure now because Amazon's doing it, Google's doing it, Microsoft's doing it. That's not how it works.
I mean, because for the same reasons that I can't take and in my in those security questionnaires and go, I have ISO 27001 because the Amazon that I run on has ISO 27001.
Right. Same thing. Yeah. Well, yeah. Companies did the same thing with PCI. Oh, well, this environment is PCI certified, therefore I'm PCI certified. No. Right. What are you doing with that data outside of that environment?
My only comment was going to be, and you touched right on it, Eric, the three people in the room, if you look at, well, I shouldn't say just the three people, but the three big guys in the room, I think had a total of $30+ billion they had promised to spend on security, but they only promised $100 million to government funded training and other programs. Mm-hmm. So remember that $30 billion into security in what they are selling. Right. And then you've already seen that there's going to be increases on different licensing already going into 2022. And I got to believe that's because you're building in additional features, some of that being security.
Right.
I just think you look at everybody in the room and the way technology is used today, the message I got without even listening to all the different sound bites was you can't slow down this flywheel. Every company needs this data transformation. We're going to continue to sell as much as we can. This movement to the cloud, you look at the profit that Google, Microsoft, and Amazon are making right now just from their cloud side.
Yeah.
Right. And you don't even have more than 10% of the market into the cloud, right? Or operating in that high function in the cloud. The amount of money that could be made to slow down that flywheel right now, no. And if you say you're going to put $30 billion towards it, they're not taking a $30 billion hit. You got to believe that.
Right.
Yeah, it's $30 billion with a, you know, with another $10 billion upside.
Again, I mean, at the end of the day, it comes down to the practitioner, right?
Right.
Unless you're getting the companies that actually have to implement the controls, implement the tools, sitting at the table in agreeance that on the manufacturing, for automotive manufacturing, this is what we agree as a collective group. This is what we're going to do to move the needle. Unless you get that concurrence, it doesn't matter what the tech companies are creating and what they're selling. I could take the greatest tool in the world, buy it. That doesn't mean anything. Doesn't mean I actually implement it. Doesn't mean I'm looking at the alerts, the telemetry data coming from it, any of that stuff.
I heard a great quote and it said, it's not the shoes you wear, it's the steps you take.
Yeah.
I like that.
And I was like, I was like, that is great on so many different levels. And when you were just saying that, Eric, that's exactly it. Right.
Yeah. No, I will say on that note, I think automotive manufacturing is getting far better. And I think we touched on this on a past podcast on how a lot of tier ones, the OEMs and everything are coming together to really move the needle and understanding that, yes, some of us are competitors in the vertical, but when it comes to cyber, we're all in it together and we need to make sure that we've got transparency, good communication, that if we have anything that hits the ecosystem on a broader scale, that we've already created those communication lines to help each other out. So I think we're moving in the right direction, but I don't think that's indicative of every vertical.
No, definitely not. I mean, and it also, this also came up in a discussion I was having in a Slack room that I'm in, the Colorado Equal Security group, which is, you know, really, really a great discussion and covers a whole lot of different verticals. But we were talking about, you know, the maturity of the relative ISACs. And you know, where to go for that kind of information and that kind of collaboration. And it's very clear that different verticals have different levels of maturity in this when it comes to the ISACs. For those that don't know, the ISACs were set up probably right around 20 years ago now, just after September 11th, when it was clear the critical infrastructure needed to be talking to each other more. And they're really focused on information sharing within a vertical. So there's the financial services ISAC, which I think is probably one of the most mature of them. There's MS ISAC, which is the multi-state. There's a REN ISAC for higher ed. There's is there an automotive ISAC? I can't remember.
There is. Yep. Okay. There's an auto ISAC.
And you know, just you name it, healthcare, etc. Power. There's an ISAC for it. And I think there's 27 of them and they all coordinate with each other across the US. That's some pretty good stuff, but they are definitely at different levels of maturity, of complexity, of working togetherness. And some of that's, you know, it's 20 years in. So I think they're probably about where they're going to be. So, you know, by having and using those kinds of industry groups to come together and do things consistently, it's very much counter to the, you know, the ideals of the business people or the sales people that are like, you know, these are our enemies. But in reality, we are all in this together on the security side. I remember working in, you know, when I was in pharma, you know, the business front was very much competitive with competitive companies. But behind the scenes, the information security teams, the technology teams were all working very closely together because we had common threats.
Right. And I think it's good to recognize too, though, that, I mean, the ISACs are really moving the needle and that's great, bringing everybody together, but that it's also not a silver bullet, right? It's not a fix, because there's an element of, to join an ISAC, you have to be so tall to ride, right? Mm-hmm. Because you're going to get a lot of good data back. You're going to get a lot of best practices, but if you have no mechanisms within your organization to take those IOCs back and plug them into your environment to actually move the needle, then there's, it's kind of there's no real intrinsic value to spending the money to join the ISAC. So there's definitely an element of maturity that's got to happen first within an organization before you can take full advantage over the ISACs.
So I'm going to be careful in my response here, because I was going to say, also going back to the vendors then, in the way you build your tools, the ability to go in and just any of the IOCs when they're put in there, let's say from the ISACs group, even let's say Microsoft, you go to their website and there's a new threat actor out there, or a new attack vector, or a new attack, and the IOCs are put up there. The ability when you go to that website just to be able to scrape the IOCs and dump them in and not have to build out all these scripts. If the vendor started looking at it from an ease of use standpoint from the security analysts that are using them, it would make it a little more practical too, especially right. when you look at the number of different IOCs out there that could be listed in any one day. The other thing I was going to mention in relation to automotive, and Eric, you mentioned the maturity of the communication and the more we're in it together. I think for several years, when you looked at the idea of like the P2 data or personal identification information or any of that, was more in line with the OEs worried about their security posture. And as you look at the rise of ransomware, it really came down to now when you look at our supply chain, the ability for the supply chain to get shut down, and even for one of the tier one suppliers to be shut down because of a tier two, meant that all the tier ones were in it together now. And you really started to see that common voice. And I literally had this discussion like a week and a half, 2 weeks ago, and someone said, yeah, but there's supply chains everywhere. And I said, understand how big the supply chains are in automotive. It's some of the largest budgets in the world and the largest purchasing budgets in North America. I go, so to have a supplier be shut down when, if you had communication, a supplier to be shut down because of a security incident, because of an attack, that information shared across all suppliers, all OEs, not only improves the speed at which they can react, improves their posturing, improves their ability to keep everybody in business. And like you said, it's that's where you start to see we're in it together. And I think that starts to make a, when you say coalition or better relationship, even from a purchasing side, where normally purchasing's the arm that's beating you down, right? And it's like, oh, the idea that you're working together, I feel like you're going to start to see supply chain awards for the ability to communicate on cybersecurity.
Yeah, I think I definitely could see that coming. And I think this, it's kind of a good transition too, because I think if you take that, we're looking at the supply chain externally, but taking this back inside companies and just cybersecurity and having the conversation in a broader business continuity perspective, you know, I think as we look at the supply chain, that we're all doing just-in-time inventory on the majority of what we're doing, but part of business continuity also means you're having the conversation across the different business elements on understanding what is my slack time, how much pent-up inventory do we have we can sustain production, where we can sustain a supply chain disruption, and still meet the demands of the OE and hit the timelines. And we've started having a lot of those conversations through, and this is the importance, you know, when you think about tabletops and playing out some of these scenarios, that just because a supplier gets hit doesn't necessarily mean, oh, everything's just down, right? This is all calculated, heavily calculated on what the disruption is, because it's no different than you could have a tornado, a hurricane. I mean, that one's real right now. There's all kinds of different elements that come into disruption. Cyber just becomes one of probably the fastest growing facets of that. Now, I guess climate change is also a huge topic right now as well, but it's got to make sure, you know, for the security practitioners that are listening, you got to have those conversations, that security in our world feels like it's the biggest thing in the world. You know, everybody's going to be focused on security, but it's one piece of the overall supply chain puzzle.
Well, and even if you take it out of supply chain and look at it in a larger risk management perspective, when you're doing entire business risk analyses. All of those things you just listed are key parts of it. And understanding, you know, how security fits into all of that is really a must have. And I think it's bi-directional though, because I think it's as important for the rest of the organization to understand how security fits into the risk picture. And it's equally important for the security for security professionals to understand how the rest of the risk in the business can affect security positively or negatively. The idea of availability risk in a data center and the likelihood of hurricanes and the likelihood of power outages or brownouts it's some of those kind of things that we don't think about, but really are close. We don't immediately think about, but are closely tied to the information security remit.
So in when you said risk management, and Eric, you were talking about supply chain. In the last year and a half, you've started to see the OEs, when they go in to say, okay, they have their risk group, their risk management group, their audit group that goes in when you're doing sourcing and sourcing evaluation. They come in and they audit your line. They come in to see your process, your production control, your quality. And they're starting to ask questions around training. And this is more just human resources, but now they're adding in cybersecurity. And before it was just a checklist. You know, do you have this in place? And like you said, you've done one thing and you're like, yep, my company does that, right? What's the easiest way to put a checkbox in there? But due to some rather large incidents for companies, when you say just in time, especially when you get into seating manufacturing, seating just in time isn't inventory of like 24 hours. It's inventory of 2 to 3 hours as they ship those seats in, and then they're even stacked into the truck backwards, all right? So that when they're taken out in order of the vehicles they're going to go into. And that's why all those facilities are as close in proximity to the manufacturing lines as possible. Mm-hmm. So with that, I just recently heard of a supplier that literally got budget overnight and went out and bought one of the most expensive tools they could when they had no budget before, because the OE had told them that they couldn't source them the new business because they failed in two areas. One of them was cybersecurity. Instantly, the management gave them budget to go out and purchase the tool that they needed or they wanted, where before they had zero budget. So think about what I'm saying there. If the OE, the original equipment manufacturer, puts a requirement out there because of supplier risk, right? And suppliers have a scorecard. And it shows their risk for their assembly line. It's part of when we were talking about PFEMA and DFEMA, right? Like if your risk assessment at the end of your process, they won't sign off and agree to your manufacturing line. Now, from a security standpoint, right? Just like they look at your shipping routes and your packaging, they're like, nope, you're not getting enough parts in that box. Redesign the box. And they'll literally tell you to go back and redesign the box that you're shipping in, because they want to make sure that from a logistics, they're saving X amount of money. Right. The same is now becoming true from security. So if you start to put those requirements out there that you have to have this at a minimum, we're not saying that you have to do all these things, but at a minimum, you have to have these things in place. And go ahead.
No, I was going to say, and I think you and I have had this conversation before, and this is what we've talked about, and so certain verticals can self-regulate. And that's exactly it, right? Because the OE set a standard. You know, for us, the German auto manufacturer set up TISACs, which is, I believe, ISO 27001 sitting under the covers. But you now have to be this tall to ride. These are the controls we want to see if we're going to source any new business from you. And I think it's a positive.
I think it is a positive, especially when you look at verticals within industry, because most of the suppliers aren't worried about P2 data getting out there, right? They're not selling. Their customer is the OEs. They only have like 10 or 12 customers, right? Because they only sell into those customers. But at the end of the day, from a manufacturing side, the biggest risk is to shut down the line and keep the line from moving forward, right? And producing. So I think that's where the auto companies looked at it before, is they were always worried about your quality, your production control. What amount of inventory do you keep down? That's why you can never move an assembly line without getting approval first. So we see how much inventory you stacked up ahead of time to make sure that if something happens, we're not shut down. Now, part of that conversation is becoming security, because I mean, you look at what happened with oil, right? And the reason I couldn't get flat white paint for my ceiling, natural disaster. You know, Texas froze, right? And boom, it shut down a bunch of the petrochemical facilities, which shut down the supply chain for months. I mean, all the way, when you look at it, it wasn't just paint, it wasn't just oil, it went all the way to decking materials. You know, if you were using any of the TimberTech or the composite, right? It really impacted. So if you're a threat actor looking at that and you're saying, oh, that's all I had to do was go shut down the person that makes this one bolt that goes into all this other stuff. Interesting, right?
Well, I was reading just this week, there was a piece, and I'll see if I can find it and put it in the show notes, about the source of the chip shortage. And it's a combination of things. It's a culmination of a lot of bad events, but apparently a large piece of it relates to taking a key supplier out of the mix. And, you know, this is not political, but the idea that Huawei was removed as a potential fabricator and a potential destination for, American products couldn't sell to Huawei. So they had to, all that work had to go elsewhere. Then you layer on, shipping increases, cost increases, you layer on natural disasters and all these things. And it's this, in so many ways, we're seeing the 100 years flood equivalent in these kinds of processes. So, you know, to what level of resiliency do we have to, start rethinking how we look at, this is a risk that we don't think will ever show up? Because I guarantee if you went 10 years ago and we're having those risk discussions inside an organization, you said, well, we don't think that, wildfires in this part are going to be so crippling that we can't be down, that we'd only be down for maybe a couple of hours if it hit a power line. Now people are rethinking that. We don't think that a shipping delay coming from East Asia back to the US would now cost 10x. Apparently it's 10x to send a shipping container what it was 12 months ago, cost-wise. And now time, you have blockage in the Suez Canal. All of these different things coming together. Are we starting to rethink, or should we be starting to think, and how should we be starting to rethink the likelihood of these risks coming to fruition?
Yeah, and I do think there is an element, though, we have to be careful that we can't play Monday morning quarterback, right? Because after an event, it's always easy to go back and point, oh, we should have seen this, should have seen this, should have seen this. Yes, because now we've seen the whole picture play out. I'm not saying that's definitively the case here, because I think there were enough warning bells that people that have dissected that there's, from a supply chain perspective, just generically speaking, there have been individuals out there that have been kind of raising this flag for a while to say, hey, this is a potential that could be coming. And COVID just sped that up that much quicker. Right. So I think there is definitely room for us to rethink some of our risk equations that how we're doing this. But I go back to something, I forget what the conversation was, and I still stand that I don't think the government's the organization to push that. I think that this is really going to have to be driven out of private equity, because change comes out of private equity, that if a company becomes less investable, that's when all of a sudden you start seeing change take place and moving the needle.
Two things I was going to say, in regards to the supply chain shortage on the chips, though, even though we knew, or chip manufacturers knew that Huawei wasn't going to be able to supply, or that the government was going to push that agenda, a lot of companies here were very excited about that because they knew their business of chips was going to increase. But then COVID happened and no company was going to sign off on budget to build additional manufacturing plants or lines. There was just too much uncertainty, right? Mm-hmm. And I think that was a big thing. The second thing I was going to say was, Dan, when you made the comment, and give me a sec, I got to clear my voice. When everybody in the room agrees, it reminded me of a movie, World War Z. And I know everyone's going to laugh, but when people are like, well, why were all these walls built in Israel, right? And they were like, well, we know why they were built. And they're like, actually, nobody believed there would be a zombie apocalypse. But we all said, if everybody in the room agreed, then there had to be one person in the room that disagree, and then put together the plan of what would you do to prevent that, right? And it kind of reminds me of literally PFEMA, DFEMA goes through all these things of, yeah, but that would never happen. But what if you can put down, if that happened, what would it affect, right? That was my little.
And I think that's the point I was trying to make before, not necessarily, Eric, that the, that people haven't been thinking about it, but I think it's that the, we think about a lot of things when doing those kind of risk equations, but the reality of how many of them could realistically happen, I think that calculus has materially changed for people over the past 18 to 24 months. And even going back, 4 or 5 years, as we look at changes in, we look at changes in climate, changes in impacts from climate. We look at, changes in political structures, inter-company tariffs, all of these kinds of things I think have really reshaped the, I guess what we thought was a very low likelihood. Now, right, these risks are starting, right? I'm letting myself believe, and maybe that's it, that they didn't believe before, but letting myself finally start to believe that these actually could possibly happen.
Well, I'd say, on a personal and a leadership level, I think that it's an opportunity that we should always be challenging on our kind of perceptions and what we think. And I actually just finished a book called Think Again by Adam Grant, I believe. Highly recommend the book, but it's really solid. But if you think about it, it's the whole premise there is not that you are not tied to your beliefs, right? That you are bound up in your ethics, what makes you up, and that you should continue to challenge your beliefs over and over again and seek out alternative viewpoints and all that stuff. But I take that and to build on what you were talking about, Dan, think about it just in the Metro Detroit area and what we've seen in the flooding. I mean, Granholm just recently asked for, what was it, Oakland County, and there was one other county that she asked to be declared a natural disaster.
I think it was Wayne too.
It was Wayne.
Yeah, because of the floods, right? Mm-hmm. But if you go back, we would have said, well, this was a 100-year flood. This was X year flood or, whatever this, we expect it to happen on this timetable. Right. And now we've had multiple occurrences within a short period of time that's led to the sequence of events. And you're right. And I think the right mentality is that we need to step back and maybe we need to shorten the time horizon and stop looking at, over at a 100-year run, this has happened this many times. Well, let's look at the last 10 years and how many times this has happened. I mean, if we look at the evolution of the cyberspace, I mean, you really can't look at it on a huge time horizon. Because if you try to compare 20 years ago to today, are they even comparable?
Archaic comparatively. Yeah, what we were doing 20 years ago. Well, think about it. At the days of the on and around September 11th, which is coming up on a 20-year anniversary in a couple of weeks. It's just a good memory in our mind. Think about the information security programs we were working on and how they have changed to today. And it is a monumental difference. Doesn't even begin to describe how much we have evolved in the last 20 years, both from business perspectives, technology perspectives, information security perspectives, privacy perspectives. It's night and day, and then night and day, and night and day again.
Right. Well, and I think that's one of the slippery slopes of data, right? Where we got to be careful. I think we've talked about this before that, I can't remember the name of the book. There was a book that was written about it that was about data sets that the broader the data set, you can actually marginalize the outliers, right? So
Wasn't Malcolm Gladwell's Outliers, was it?
No, I don't think it was. I'd have to go back. I'd have to look at Audible and all the books that I've gone through. Everything starts to blend together at some point.
Yeah.
If you look at the cyber risk data, I think as a cyber practitioner that my goal is I always want to get as much data as possible to drive decisions. But I think there's an element of you have to be careful and how far you're going that you can actually cloud out the data that you're trying to glean from the given data set. And I know I'm kind of off on a tangent here, but I think the same thing happens in a lot of our risk actuarial data, that if you look at too broad of a time horizon, you miss what's actually happening today and the risks that we should be worried about.
And I'll actually add on to that, because I think, you know, we as a field also get into a lot of analysis paralysis too, where we're not just because we're looking at too wide of a time horizon, but also because we think, oh, well, we can collect more data sources and try and get this together back to a, and I don't remember if this was before or after we pressed the record button, you know, the idea that, you know, all of this data going in, all this information security data going into one place, whether it be a SIM or whether it be, you know, something new and with an X in the title, the important part is what you do with it and not just that you're collecting all the datas. And I think in this case too, we need to, you know, there's a point where you need to cut off, you know, put some bounds around it. But I think you also need to look at it from different, back to the, and it's not a tangent, Eric, because I think it comes right back to the risk discussion quite well, is that we, you know, you look at it from different time horizons. And say, all right, in the 1 year span, here's what we've seen. In the 3 year span, here's what we've seen. In the 5 year span, here's what we've seen. And then you start to, you know, look at how that trajectory has changed and will change, and attempt to project where it's going to head, and redefine and recalculate that 100 years risk.
I'm going to put one thing out there in regards to
just the one thing
in regards to ransomware. Versus theft of data.
And before you do, what's the distinction of those?
And where I'm going with this is, ransomware has brought to light that people have to start either A, investing in resources, tools, training, et cetera. But what it's done though, is brought visibility into the fact that ransomware is a problem. What that in turn has done has companies in a position where they started to invest in tools that gave them better visibility. By getting better visibility, they started to see that, guess what? In our environment has been things living that have been taking data, have never ransomed us. And as a threat actor located in a completely different world, not this world of ransomware actors, but this world of a country that just wants the data to understand how we build things, how we make things, how our economy operates. And if you think about this, a lot of companies that end up saying they had a breach do so because their data is found on the web being sold. This country is not selling that data. This country is just mining the data. So even if you found out that this actor had taken your data and has a bunch of your intellectual property around how you build, let's say for American Axle, how you build different chassis and programs, you the metallurgy that allowed you to lightweight the material 20% less, right? To give you a competitive advantage. They have now taken that information when they're producing sunroofs that literally match your exact sunroof. And they even stamp your company name on it to say company similar, right? Like this goes back 15 years ago. I can remember traveling and seeing an auto show in a specific country, our exact sunroof. And it literally had our name similar in it, like in the mold.
But this has been in the sunglass industry since the beginning of time, and the perfume industry since the beginning of time. Think back to those.
Hey, I still like my Folkleys. What are you talking about?
I'm just saying when people used to tell me that, you know, that a certain competitor was so good at reverse engineering the ability to make this product. And that's why on our drawings specifically, there was the internal drawing and the customer drawing. And on our internal drawings, it had on there the very specific ways to manufacture the product, right? So unless you were actually in possession of those drawings, you could see the part, try to reverse engineer it, but the actual process of making it was just as important as the tolerances that were on the drawing.
Yeah.
So, that's where I was going with this is, everyone screams about ransomware, but it's brought to light to put better tools in place, because for a long time, if you didn't know the data was being taken and looked at, then you never thought you had a problem.
Yeah. Ever. And I'm going to build on that as well, because I think there is a cautionary tale to be told to organizations that get on the buzzword bandwagon, that if you look at the news right now, everything is about ransomware. Just like if you go back a couple of years, everything was about DDoS. Are we protected from DDoS that we might get shut down from that? All right, so everybody's focused on ransomware. We have to be prepared, and this is already starting to transition, that ransomware is going to be the watch what I'm doing over here, not what I'm doing here. and data exfiltration. I mean, look, let's just break it down. Look at the evolution of ransomware, right? Ransomware started, and this is there's a story here that every time you shut down an avenue for a criminal organization to make money, they pivot because they are a business at the end of the day, and they're going to try to make money in some other way.
And they don't have to ask the board of directors for a lot of permission and market studies before they do. So they can move way faster than many of us can.
Absolutely. And I think they're actually way more creative than most of us. But if you look at it, I mean, ransomware started at that. All right, I'm just going to lock down your data. I'm going to encrypt your data. Give me money. I'll give you the keys. You can decrypt it. Cool. Companies started to get wise to that. So you started to come up with, well, I've got better backup strategies, air gapping, 3-2-1 strategy, and all of those that started to combat that. That's fine. We're going to acknowledge that at some point my data is going to get encrypted. I have the means to restore it. Next evolution of that you started to have either time-based ransomware that, all right, you can restore it, but guess what? The ransomware piece is still sitting in those backups. I'll lock it back up again. Or you also have the data exfiltration piece that, all right, you're not really paying for it to decrypt your data because I'm sure you can get it back. But if you don't pay me, I'm going to publicly release that data, right? And then you get into the third wing of that and what we saw in healthcare. And I know we've covered it here, that you've got the data encryption piece, data exfiltration piece, and then you start to go after the customers. I stole your data, Mr. and Mrs. Customer. Pay me or I'm going to release that data, right? That third evolution. So every time it's cat and mouse. And I think we've got to start thinking out ahead of this ransomware game and understanding what is next to come. Where do we need to be focused down the road? And I think far too often we get caught up in this mentality that because a news headline came out that we get asked the questions, can we prevent ransomware? Well, the question's got to be much broader than just ransomware because we lock ourselves into creating point solutions, point controls to combat today and not focused on tomorrow.
Wait, you're not saying
that. I'm off my soapbox.
Yeah, I mean, from the same larger, wider industry that has us taking off shoes because one time somebody used their shoes for something. I mean, we stay focused and until we have better information, we have to do the reactive thing, but it's our responsibility to get that broader information and think ahead and move ahead and be prepared ahead and evolve along with the attacks. But at the same time, are we doing ourselves a disservice by keeping doing the old thing just because we were? Yeah, the longer we focus on ransomware, great, we can't get rid of it. We can't stop focusing on ransomware right now because it's still an active threat. You know, are we still going to see how do you protect against ransomware question in 10 more years in the, you know, God help me if we haven't already evolved off the 300 question survey. Now it'll be 500 questions because of all the new threats in the meantime.
Right. Well, and this is where I think if the government's going to get involved, to Brian's point, let's focus on the bigger issue at hand on a global scale, what countries are actually doing. You know, if you go back and I want to say we talked about it here before on the solar panels, that if you go back a couple of years, actually, I think it was probably about 10 years now, there was a solar panel company that nearly went under because the Chinese government was able to steal their IP and get to market before they could and start selling them on a global scale.
Mm-hmm.
Technically, look at Nortel in Canada is a great example of, you know, one of the biggest telecom.
What used to be Nortel.
Yeah, what used to be Nortel. And what they found out years later was they were basically having all their data, all their intellectual property was being siphoned overseas to a specific country. Now, I'm not going to pretend to know a lot about automotive, but if I was an automotive, I would put a huge, huge focus on making sure that right now with this paradigm shift into autonomy and electric vehicles, I was making sure I wasn't losing my intellectual property. Now is the time where you don't even want to be running the race at the same speed. You want to be running the race far faster, far better with your technology for years to come without letting anybody else have it if you're truly creating breakthrough technologies. So, well, ransomware affects your production, and that's what the plants care about because that's where the profit centers are. So you can't shut me down. I got to be up and running at all time. I need to be in production at all time. Great. But if you want to stay in production and be truly competitive and go from an industry that doesn't sit dead last in profitability, then keep that competitive edge by making sure your intellectual property isn't being siphoned out with a giant straw.
I can neither I can neither confirm or deny if said focus is being placed on IP and what's to come with electrification.
Well, how does all right, Brian, you know, you bring up a good point. So now put your money where your mouth is. How do organizations push back and say all this great digital digitization work we've been doing, it's adding undue risk, and we need to slow the business down in order, because, you know, we've done all this great automation, made everything really, really available, we're using, you know, cloud syncing services, we've got our intellectual property in every plant all over the place, it's wonderful, you know, and it is therefore much easier to be taken. We don't have as great of control over it, but we've made it much more available and people can get at it easier. And therefore, you know, it's created the oil that keeps that keeps things greased and moving. Do we have to pull back on that? And how do you start to position that in an industry that has really embraced moving this stuff forward with automation and technology?
Well, Dan, we don't need to slow down. Google, Apple, and Microsoft just said they're going to put $30 billion into security. We just got to keep pushing this out as fast as possible.
Oh, boy.
That was great. Full
circle.
And
that's going to solve the problem, right?
Oh, that is phenomenal. Yeah, I think a lot of that comes back to, we've got to be willing to rewrite the rules. You know, we were kind of talking about this with risk, right? That if we want to bury our heads in the sand and continue to do continue to approach security the way we've always approached security, with the same set of controls, the same risk offsets, then we're going to lose that game. I think we got to be willing to take a step back, acknowledge that how we did it yesterday is not how we need to do it tomorrow, and be willing to rewrite those rules and rebuild those environments. But at the same time, that's not just on a technical level. I think, and this is where it gets back to the changing dynamics of the CISO and being able to articulate that vision and why that matters to the organization, why that matters for the longevity of the company going into the future, and how it's got to be kind of a harmonious relationship of not only evolving the technology that we're about to sell into the marketplace, but where cyber and information security kind of comes into that whole fold to help intrinsically protect the evolution of the company.
Eric, you also mentioned the fact that there's a bigger focus on the intellectual property side. And I think that's where, on the supply chain, you look at the risks that the OEs were worried about from ransomware on the supply chain. Well, this also goes back to the fact that OEs only assemble the vehicle. They don't necessarily build it. All those parts come from suppliers, and a lot of intellectual property is sometimes shared between OE and supplier as they create these new technologies, whether it's for battery, whether it's for the gearboxes, et cetera. And same thing from the autonomy side, the amount of investment that's being invested by, you know, the top 10 OEs or OE suppliers are just doing a phenomenal amount of investment in creating new intellectual property and partnering with tech companies. That's the last thing that you would want siphoned out, that you've helped work with supplier A and then supplier A didn't have good posturing, and there goes all their intellectual property, which is allowing, you know, said competitor to be able to supply that to now your competitor, right? So right. It goes to the level where you said that, you know, we all compete at this level up here trying to sell vehicles or parts, but we're all in the game together down here. And I think very much so, not just from a ransomware standpoint, but from an intellectual property standpoint, if you want to keep your competitive edge, that's the second part of it. And where do we go from there? You know, when I would jokingly said that no need to slow down because companies have just made a $30 billion pledge. I don't know what I think on that comment, besides they want to keep that flywheel going as fast as possible because they're pushing product out there. But I think that in the future, there's going to be more, how do you say, responsibility from the tech companies in when you're pushing product out there, and you look at the vulnerabilities that are out there. And as these things are discovered, even our governments have used vulnerabilities without reporting them in the past because it gave them a leg up in cyber warfare. Mm-hmm. So you're always going to have that. I just think there needs to be more accountability in how fast things are pushed to market.
Well, I think it's worth taking a step back real quick as well. And this isn't unique to automotive manufacturing. You know, as we talk about intellectual property, as we talk about PII, that is going to be what is important is different based on the vertical of the company, but is a critical early on step for any good security program is identifying, and the most common term thrown out there is the crown jewels, right? And I know that that kind of harkens back to the idea of we're building castles and moats and drawbridges, which is kind of an outdated model. But I think the concept of the crown jewel still persists, that you have to first define what matters most. And once you define what matters most, now you can start building controls. Because if you try to protect everything at the same classification level, you will lose at the end of the day. That's just, none of us have the budget, the capacity, the people to protect everything. So you have to be, to put Martin Bally terms, laser focused on what you're trying to protect.
But the challenge is that our businesses aren't laser focused as they used to be. You know, I go back to some stories of people I knew, you know, 20, 25 years ago. They worked for food companies and the recipes were the crown jewels and they lived in a physical vault. You knew who went in, they were in the library, you knew who went in, you knew who went out. You checked them in, you checked them out, you made sure there was no cameras, da, da, da. But though all those companies with vertical integration, with acquisitions, with, you know, current business structure, it is hard, increasingly hard, nay impossible for a company to say, this is where this is all of our crown jewels, because they're spread across geographies. They're spread across business areas. You know, companies are so diverse and are doing less and less on their own. Brian, to the point you made, there's all this sharing. There's all this, you know, crosstalk between outsourced suppliers. This was a lot easier when everything happened in-house. Now, well, you know, can we put that genie back in the bottle? Can I, as a company, say this is my most important thing, knowing that 3/4 of my most important things are actually managed by this company down the way, who may or may not. I mean, this is why we do these kind of downstream third-party risk analyses. But can we actually get to a point where those are meaningful?
Let's play with that, though, Dan. I mean, if you think about, because I know who you're talking about on the physical vault and the recipe and all of that. Why can't we get to a state where we now have the digital instantiation of that physical vault? And that if you are going to play, if you're going to have access to it, you're coming into this digital gateway, this courtyard, you're locked into this environment, and this is the only way that you can actually, the military has been doing this for a long time, right? If you think about that, if you need to get into certain systems, it's air gapped, you have to use this computer that can connect to it. You can do some of the same thing with digitization, and not that the cloud is, you know, the end all be all, the fix for everything.
I just put XDR on it. That'll fix it all.
But if you look at some of those cloud architectures, we can start building out some of those physical vaults in a digital world, cloud native, by controlling. I mean, if we start to get into zero trust and understanding identity, the devices, the context around somebody connecting and how they can get into this, I think we can start to create those worlds. But again, we have to be willing to give up yesterday's controls. Yesterday's controls were all about subnetting and breaking things, VPN connections, and everything is housed internally. And how am I going to get somebody into it? We got to be willing to break that down. And instead of having 70 different instances of intellectual property spread across the world, what if we created a single instance where we could be laser focused on watching it in a cloud environment? I think it's possible. I'm not saying it's easy, but it's possible.
But it's going to require a change in the thinking of how businesses run as well. And I don't know that right now is, that's not an easy thing to, it's not an easily accepted thing unless the business, it's going to take the right kind of person, CISO, to communicate that in the right kind of way. And I think that's an area where, as people are growing in their careers, this is a great time to focus back on relationships and communications and the importance of those in information security leadership, especially as these roles become part of the broader businesses, the broader organizations, and being able to share those and stand toe to toe with the people who are making product or deciding how products and services are developed and say, we need to do it this way. We can't move quite as fast, but we're also fighting against 20 years of being in office that says, I'm sorry, you can't do that. And you know, we have to balance out, you know, keeping the business running, keeping the organization going and things selling and things being made with a reasonable set of controls that won't be immediately bucked at, like when you tell your 13-year-old it's time for bed.
And Eric, you just gave me another idea around Chawanamushi and the idea that it's this container, right, that's isolated. When you were talking about the cloud, what if we put all those assets, right, or intellectual property in one area and we're laser focused on just guarding that one area? And then, of course, Dan had to throw out the comment about XDR. And I was like, what if it was Chawanamushi in this little container that everything was, you know, the only person in was you. It's not a shared plate that everybody can stick a fork in. Anyways, I just went off on another tangent there. So to all the listeners.
Well, it's a great opportunity for the information and the information roles inside of an organization, libraries, data management, to work with information security to create this safe haven. You know, we've talked about it from password stores. We've talked about it from, you know, these great data repositories, but you know, it's kind of like, it's like an HSM for data. Kind of neat. Product will be released when, Eric?
TBD.
Go to market next week.
Right. We need some of that $30 million.
Is the go to market next week? It's like, yeah, we'll have that out next week. And we've double checked it, triple checked it, quadruple checked it. There's no problems with this.
I want to tie this back. I want to bring this back around because we're getting close to the end of the hour. And I want to tie this back around for just one more whip around the public and the private piece of these announcements. There was a comment that was made, and I don't have the quote, but it was basically that the government is, you know, not very little of what happens in our country, in the United States of America, happens through the government. There is a huge reliance on public-private partnerships, on private organizations to drive the direction of these things. And I think that was one of the roots of the reasons for this particular summit was we need these private industries. And in this case, the largest of the private industries, as well as a diverse set of private industries across, again, the insurance field, the high tech field, and others, to be able to drive this. But at the end of the day, there are those verticals, Eric, you made this point earlier, there are those verticals that have in their business model reasons to do this better than others, because, like, mostly because health and safety is on the line, but that drives business. If a car gets broken into electronically and somebody crashes and dies, that's a problem. You're not going to get good sales. So there's incentive there. But I guess, how do we pull this back around and what the government's role in regulating some of this, especially, and let's exclude the industries that have health and safety. And, you know, at the end of the day, if they do something wrong, people die. Because I think those, like I said, I think those have a built-in reason to want to do better and to need to do better, because that, you know, health and safety drives the dollar. But the rest, how do we find that balance between innovation and regulation, and do so in a way that lets the company still continue to meaningfully grow and do business, but not be completely focused on profit at all costs? Because that, without the regulation and without the impending doom of health and safety, that seems to be where many have headed.
Yeah, it's a tough one. I definitely think
that, and it's easy when you're in an industry that's in those where the people, you know, if you don't, the people die. It's really easy to think about things much more concretely than the others, where it's, well, it prints money, let's go. And why would we put controls in? Because that just costs us money.
We don't have to look very, very far back to pick out a pipeline, right? That was kind of in that mentality that life and death wasn't on the line, that it was cheaper to just pay ransom and all of that. And
I feel it was like 2 weeks ago.
I feel like we've beat on them quite a bit, but I think that's from my perspective. I think that is looking at a vertical that has no reason to innovate and self-regulate itself. And I think that one is prime for the government to step in. And let's be honest, I mean, does that get, and I forget, I should know the answer to this. Is the pipeline, is that that's considered a utility or no?
You're talking about the like Colonial Pipeline?
Yeah.
It is part of critical infrastructure. It is not, I don't believe, a utility. It's a supply. It's a utility supply. So I don't know that it's considered. It's not a power and energy itself. No.
Right. Okay. But in either case,
I think that after they were impacted, a bunch of companies got added to what could be considered critical infrastructure or critical to national
stability. Did they expand it? Okay.
Yeah.
That's good. I think that's where the incentive is not there to self-regulate. I think that's where that's prime for government intervention to step in. And by all means, let Chris Jerusha, he'll come up with the frameworks. And it's, if anybody can do it, he can. I think that one would be a great one.
I've been really impressed with the level of focus coming out of Washington over the last few months from the information security space, both within CISA, within the White House, within the Department of Defense and others. It's been a really neat mindset and approach on a creative new way of approaching these problems. And I guess I'm quite hopeful.
Yeah. No, I think keeping the topic top of mind is good. I think we just need to reframe who's in the room. And I think starting with the big tech companies, just for me, I don't think that plays out moving the needle. I think it creates headlines. I think you almost got to go back to, I'm going to hate saying this, but kind of that czar mentality that you have security over different verticals and pulling together kind of companies that are leading in a given space to help set the pace, help set the level of you have to be this tall to ride and start building that out, incentivizing the various verticals to self-regulate and build that out themselves.
And with that, I think that's a great way to close out this episode of the Great Security Debate. Thank you for joining us. This has been yet another really great discussion around risk, around regulation, around another R word that I'll think of and put into the title of the episode. It's one of those topics that is so, it's right in front of us, but sometimes hard to put your arms around. So, Eric, and Brian, thank you so much for having this great debate yet again. And thanks to listeners for being here. Thank you for subscribing. If you haven't subscribed, you can go to your favorite podcast application and subscribe. Just search for the Great Security Debate podcast. If you are on that application and feel like leaving a rating or feel like leaving a comment, we'd love to see it. We want to make this show better. You can also email your comments to feedback@greatsecuritydebate.net. And you can find us on Twitter @securitydebate or on the web, www.greatsecuritydebate.net, where you can also find all of our past episodes. Tell your friends, tell your family, tell your mom, tell your dad, tell your little sister, and even have the dog listen. We'll be back soon with another Great Security Debate. Thank you so much, and we'll see you next time.